Hi, this is Bill Indicke for the Streets.mn podcast, conversations about transportation, public space, and urban design in the Twin Cities. For the second week in a row, the podcast conversation is going to be with a guy named Andy about his new book. Only this time I'm talking to Andy Singer, a cartoonist, writer, and bicycle advocate who lives in St. Paul. For decades, Andy has drawn No Exit, a one-panel cartoon that appears in papers around the world. While Andy's work ranges all over the usual cartoon territory, over the years he has become famous for his work about transportation policy, drawing panels that lampoon highway spending or reveal the frustrating paradoxes behind our car-centric urban priorities. Earlier this summer, Andy released a new book called Why We Drive, a collection of cartoons and essays about the history and breadth of automobility in the U.S. cities. The book combines Andy's deep knowledge about transportation design with his cynical sense of humor and makes for a quick and enjoyable read. A few months ago, after watching a Twins-Oakland game together at Target Field, Andy and I sat down at Glick's Bar in downtown Minneapolis to blab about the book, about biking in the Twin Cities, and about why MnDOT remains stuck in drive mode. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Before I play the tape, though, please consider donating to Streets.mn. As our site grows, we're trying to raise a few dollars to help cover our hosting costs, and I would definitely appreciate any help you can provide. The donate button is easily found on the main Streets.mn page, helpfully marked in orange. Thanks for those of you who have already contributed a few dollars. It really does help. So that said, on with the show.
Okay, well then, welcome to the podcast for today. I'm here with Andy Singer, who is a man about town. He's you are the cartoonist, right? You're a cartoonist.
Yeah.
Originally from Berkeley, California, you live in St. Paul, and you're also the longtime head of the St. Paul Bicycle Coalition.
Well, a long time, meaning I think we've been around for 2 years or something like that. But and then also, amongst the anti-car cartoonists, there's Roger Lutein, who lives in Minneapolis, and Ken Avedor, who lives in St. Paul now but used to live in Minneapolis. So,
and in fact,
the Twin Cities has, like, three of the leading sort of bike and anti-car cartoonists.
No, why is that? I think that because neither you nor Ken are from here. And I think it's maybe just because the Twin Cities has a decent, no, it's terrible, but not, for America, a decent anti-car or like non-motorized possible lifestyle.
It's a good city. I love the Twin Cities. And like I had visited, my cousin lives here and lives about 10 blocks from where I live now. And I had visited my cousin on a couple of occasions and like seen Big Brain Comics, which is a great comic book shop in Minneapolis, and cruised around the Twin Cities, and my wife got two job offers. One was in Cincinnati, and one was here. And I was like,
"Oh yeah, just as long as there's no sound, is that okay?" Okay, cool, dude.
One job offer was Cincinnati, and one was here, and I was like, "Let's go to the Twin Cities," because I had been to Cincinnati, and it was definitely brutal carscape. And I like the Twin Cities. Immediately coming here, even in the 90s, I was like, oh, wow, it's bikeable and it's, you know, kind of hip, and I liked it.
Yeah. Can I just also set the context where we are? We were just at the Twins game on a Thursday afternoon, and the Twins lost to the Oakland A's 8-2. You're from Oakland.
That's right. Or
Berkeley. You're from the Bay Area, and you're a diehard Oakland A's fan. And so I'm a Twins fan, and so it was fun. We met up for the game, and now we're going to talk about cars and your book, your new book called Why We Drive, which came out this year. And it's kind of a compilation. It's your second book about automobile culture and cartooning. And what's the name of the press that this was released
on? Microcosm.
Microcosm.
It's a rinky-dink publisher in Oregon, Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
Who are good. They used to be based in Indianapolis, I think. And it's a guy named Joe Beal,
okay.
And they print a lot of stuff on politics and comics and things like that.
So yeah, we're going to talk about the book, but first, yeah. So we have three well-known kind of car culture cartoonists in the Twin Cities, and Ken Avedor and his wife Roberta have been on this podcast before talking about urban sketching, which I know they do, and they're big into that. But yeah, there's something about the Twin Cities that draws sort of people who have a different vision, I guess, maybe, and
It's definitely one of the few really livable Midwestern cities.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
You know, like Chicago, Twin Cities. There's some small ones like Iowa City and Madison that are nice places to be, but like the Twin Cities is nice. It's a cool place.
I like
place.
It too. And yeah. And we both live in St. Paul.
Yep.
Yeah. It's a good town. Good town.
St. Paul.
You know, you and I ain't even working for a long time trying to improve the bicycle infrastructure in St. Paul and having very little luck or success at this point. But, yeah, anyway. So that's
positive,
the story.
Little positive things happen.
That's the story. When did you start doing cartooning? And do you call it cartooning? Are you okay with that moniker?
Yeah, sure.
You're not? Okay.
Yeah. Let's see. 1991.
Yeah, like, did you always know you wanted to draw things on napkins?
I was a painting major in college, and then I got out of college, and like even while I was in college, did a lot of crappy jobs, mostly copy and print shops. And in the late 1980s, Kodak came out with a very slick photocopier that printed really high quality blacks, and it was the first photocopier that printed really high quality black, solid black areas of stuff that almost looked as if it was offset print. And it actually, in my opinion, started the zine revolution in the late 80s. So, like, people started making these zines or little magazines or little publications made on photocopiers that they would give out to their friends. And I worked at copy and print shops, and I realized that if I drew in pen and ink, that I could Xerox and make nice copies of them and give them to people or mail them to people. And so I started getting into drawing in pen and ink. And in college, I did a couple of illustration jobs for the Ithaca Times and like a couple other places. And when I graduated from college and moved back to the San Francisco Bay Area, living with my mom for 6 months.
That's exactly like my story.
Until we were killing each other.
Yeah.
I got a job there also working at a copy and print shop. And I was submitting my stuff to various newspapers. And some guy actually at the East Bay Express said, well, we don't really like your stuff for illustration, but have you ever thought about doing comics? And I'd actually never thought about it. And the Daily Californian, which was the one daily paper in Berkeley, California, used to have an election for a cartoonist and columnist at the end of every semester, or at the end of every half year or whatever. And so I submitted cartoons for it, and I got elected, and that was the start of it. I discovered I really like the combination of words and images. And
well, your cartoons are awesome, and I'm, I don't know, they're great. Like, I have your book because you gave it to me, called Cartoons. Which is just they're one panel little strips, right? Kind of like the Far Side used to be, and your style is a kind of distinctive, I'd say clean kind of look. And then often there's some political stuff. It's usually just sort of, I don't know, whatever. Your cartoons are great, and they're still,
your columns are great, man.
Thanks, but they're still kind of appear around the world, sort of in a weekly formats in papers in really weird places.
Yeah,
right?
My peak in sort of cartoon world was maybe 2003 or 2004. I ran in 24 papers, mostly alternative weeklies, but I was in the St. Paul Pioneer Press, and sometimes once a week in a couple dailies. And as a freelancer, you are responsible for drawing the stuff, sending out the stuff, marketing the stuff, billing people who run your stuff, and it's a lot of work. And after 2004, you know, fewer and fewer places have run it. I mean, I started doing cartooning in 1992, sort of self-syndicating, and there's still like 8 or 10 places that run it, but most of my income at this point comes from commissioned illustration.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I still.
But
I
which
still
papers run your cartoon stuff?
They're all little alternative weeklies. Eugene Weekly, a paper called Random Links in San Pedro, California, the East Bay Monthly, papers like that.
Oh yeah,
you know, so nothing amazing. I'm actually currently running in China in a publication called what is it? New China Weekly.
What could a Chinese person possibly think of your cartoon?
I've had to actually think a lot about the fact that America, for example, Americans read from left to right, you know, or English people read from left to right because that's how we read language, whereas Chinese read from right to left. So a lot of my cartoons, I have to reverse them in Photoshop so that a Chinese audience can read them. And then I have to sort of think about, like, you know, are pet gags going to appeal to Chinese? Nah, because most people don't have pets, you know, or like, but actually in China, a lot of the transportation cartoons are really appealing because China is going through this kind of crazy time where the Chinese government has been adopting Western transportation or American transportation planning, which means car-oriented transportation planning, whereas originally China was known for people getting everywhere by bicycle.
Yeah, the flying pigeon, that was the famous Chinese bicycle.
Yeah.
That Mao really liked and backed, and I don't know, but yeah, you're right. Like, you just posted on Facebook the other day the link to the traffic jam that went on for 10 days.
A 9-day traffic jam. I mean, China is regularly having these traffic jams that go on for multiple days where, like, people on bicycles are having to come up and feed drivers who are stuck in traffic. And I don't know what they do with their, like, urine and, you know, defecation or whatever the heck, or where they sleep, but they're stuck in, like, basically on freeways for multiple days getting to where they're going.
So I always said that my personal hell was to be trapped in the shout house in the basement of Block E. But actually, I think being in a 9-day traffic jam in Beijing would be pretty bad, too.
Yeah, that's definitely up there on the list of, you know.
Well, I think I first saw you. I noticed your cartoons many years ago, but I first saw you in person when you were giving a lecture behind the old Arise bookstore on Lindale Avenue. It was kind of a leftist bookstore, and you had like a slide projector, and you talked for half an hour about parking lots and urban design. And I hadn't really, this is probably 2003, this was right before you moved to like California or New York.
Yeah, just for a year.
Yeah. This is, what year was that then?
05, 06. So maybe this was 04, 03, or 04, somewhere
in
there.
It was like kind of right when I started getting interested in sort of more in-depth urban design, urban planning ideas. And so your lecture was actually really interesting to me. There's a lot of stuff I didn't really know about, like about parking lot minimums and site restrictions or whatever, and the history of downtown. I hadn't really delved into that stuff at that point, and I really liked your lecture. And now you've kind of turned that into this new book that you came out with. So you want to just talk about the book a little bit? Where did this book come from?
Yeah, it actually came from one time I got, because of cartoons, I would get invited to do talks. And a guy who was involved with the Village Building Convergence in Portland, Oregon, invited me to the Village Building Convergence.
What is that?
The Village Building Convergence is this great sort of event, which I still think goes on every year in Portland, and it's a coalition of different groups. There's a group in Portland that's devoted to what they call intersection repair, and they are the ones who paint the big mandalas in the intersections, which the Twin Cities has adopted as paint the pavement, but that started in Portland. And then there's also people who are into urban gardening and urban, they call it permaculture, where they put in native plants and stuff in medians on streets or rain gardens or stuff like that. And so intersection repair consists of these people coming into an intersection and putting a big mandala in the intersection, which community members help paint, and then planting permaculture gardens. And then also there's a group in Portland who's into building with cob, which is a mixture of mud and straw, basically. And they build benches and public buildings and things like that out of mud, straw, or straw bale construction. And so I got invited in 2004 to come to this thing and do a talk. So I had to prepare a talk for that. And in the process of doing that, I kind of like developed the beginnings of this book or the beginnings of this talk. And then I realized around the same time that people needed to focus more in the environmental movement on what was happening with departments of transportation, state DOTs. And I realized all the different ways, both in Minnesota and in my where I grew up in Oakland and Berkeley, California, how departments of transportation or DOTs have this huge environmental impact, how they are incredibly powerful politically in state politics, And you know, for a variety of reasons, the slide talk sort of morphed into a discussion of DOTs and the history of highway politics.
Yeah, yeah, and that's what this book is, really. So the book's, what did Conrad Defevre call it, a thin volume or something?
I don't know. He was like
we don't need to complain about
conspiracy theory.
But like it's a small little book. It's, first of all, it's not really big. It's really, it's a quick read.
It's 100-something, 60 pages or whatever.
But half the pages,
of it are images.
Yeah, half the pages are either a picture of somewhere in the Twin Cities, usually, or a cartoon that you've drawn, illustrating sort of the concepts that you're talking about on the right side, which is a narrative about kind of about our car culture today and where it came from and what the main issues are. And it's called Why We Drive, the Past, Present, and Future of Automobiles in America. So,
yeah, I mean, it's modeled around a slide talk. It's kind of a slide talk in book form,
yeah.
You know, where you have an image and then I'm going to talk about things related to that image.
Yeah.
And I use photographs and maps and, also cartoons. But and it's got a lot of images from the Twin Cities because that's where I've lived for the last 13 years. And from Berkeley, California, where I grew up, and also Boston. My wife was doing a PhD at Boston College for a while, so we lived in Boston, Massachusetts.
Yeah, the north end of Boston. What do you like about the north end of Boston?
The north end of Boston is a pre-automotive. I mean, I think if you're looking for models of urban design, I think it's helpful to look at pre-automotive sections of cities. And in Boston, that would be the north end of Boston, which was built in the 1700s and 1800s. And it has these, for the most part, except for Hanover Street, it has like very tiny, narrow streets. And it's designed for pedestrians.
Yeah, and Jane Jacobs, who's kind of my heroine, she wrote about the North End a lot in her great book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, and about how it was viewed as a slum. And I bet in 1953 or whatever, the Boston powers that be would have had no problem with just raising it if they could have done it.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, they didn't, in a way. But there was some sort of political, cohesiveness to that old neighborhood, and plus it's historic too. They're like the old North Church.
Well, now that
there.
Neighborhood or Beacon Hill or some of the other old neighborhoods, and this is true in the Twin Cities, are the most popular places to live.
Yeah,
you know, precisely because they're walkable.
Yeah,
you can be, you can 5 minutes, you can get to a grocery store or a bar or a bank or whatever. I mean, you can like, everything you need is right there. It's really awesome.
So let's just talk about your book. I'll just go through it. I found a couple spots that I really liked. This is the beginning. You kind of describe like the deep-seated roots of our car culture in America today and how ubiquitous it is, right? It's everywhere. It's really everywhere. And so the cartoon is really neat. It's from birth to death in a car. And, it has pictures of people through their whole lives, starting from car seats, playing with cars when they're kids, getting your first car when you're 16, being in a car accident or whatever, and dying and being in a hearse at the end of your life. And basically what great percentage of our lives we spend just in within cars. And you write, like the science fiction movie The Matrix, giving up your car unplugs you from the matrix of American car culture. From birth, you are unconsciously lured into a car and lured into seeing the world from the viewpoint of a car windshield. Fortunately for me, my father liked bicycles and trains. So, yeah, just tell me about that and about growing up a little bit. So how did you escape car culture? Because I agree with you.
Yeah, my dad was a New Yorker and grew up in Manhattan in New York City. And
oh, that explains everything, huh?
Yeah, and I think he actually, I mean, he was a big, he drank and smoked and did a lot of activities that are not healthy. But the mere fact that he walked to work every day for 35 years, I think, saved him. And, New York City is a city where if you own a car or you're trying to park a car or drive somewhere, I mean, you're actually penalized. It's not, you can't, it's difficult to drive around Midtown New York. a friend of mine, had to get a refund from Loxa Airlines. He had worked down in Costa Rica for a while, and he lived out in the suburbs and was driving into New York City, and he asked me if I would drive his car around Midtown while he went into Lhasa Airlines to negotiate with them for the refund for this ticket. And so I got into his car. This was at like 50th Street and 6th Avenue or something, and he went into Lhasa Airlines. And he was in there for 20, 25 minutes. I made it around the block once in 20 to 25 minutes. I mean, it was absolutely bumper to bumper, not moving traffic. And that's the reality of driving in New York City. And so, you know, I think my dad, just by virtue of living in New York City, appreciated that if you wanted to get around, I mean, you had to either take the subway or walk or ride a bicycle.
Yeah, well, my dad lived in New York for a couple of years and had a car and would park it on the street in Manhattan. And but he's crazy like that. And I, for some reason, when I was living in Brooklyn for a year and a half, too, I had a car and I never used it once. Or maybe I did use it like once or twice during the year. But I would have to move it across the street three times a week, and I got so many parking tickets. Like in that period of time, because you just, you know, you're lazy, you forget, and then the cops come ticket you,
and they have crazy parking regulations of like odd weekends on you know, Tuesdays you have to.
No, I mean, having a car in that city is insane, but people do it. I guess wealthy people have cars there because it's really expensive to park there.
Yeah, I mean, for a garage, a place to park your car is the price of a nice two-bedroom apartment in the Twin Cities. Seriously.
Well, I agree.
It's actually like a similar amount of space, and that's an issue that I also wanted to talk about in this book is people look at automobiles as an issue of energy efficiency or of gas or these kind of issues, but really, like, the main drawback of automobiles is that they waste so much space, like physical space. And the fact that in cities, in order to park your car and maneuver your car to a parking place or service your car or buy your car requires huge amounts of space. And that space requirement is what destroys urban areas. It turns, like, urban areas like downtown St. Paul into park and ride lots. And
well, we're sitting in one right now. We're in an old building, Glick's, which is from the turn of the century, but it's surrounded by a giant service parking lot, Block D, right next to a transit station. And half of downtown Minneapolis is surface parking lots, and it has been for 50 years, you know?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, and you know, if you use that land that was in your urban area for people to live in, then they could live right in the land and not have to, like, commute to downtown. And it's an incredibly wasteful model of urban design, of human design, where you're having, like, people live out in some rural area and commute into downtown, use valuable space for parking, and work at the jobs in downtown, take all the money, and leave out to suburbia.
Yeah.
And they don't even get to enjoy the benefits of suburbia, really, because they're spending their whole time on the road commuting.
And so you unplugged. Like, have you ever owned a car, Andy?
I've never owned a car. I've driven an incredible amount of miles for somebody who doesn't own a car.
And can I add that you have a garage door opener clicker hanging from your collar?
I do, except that the only thing in my garage is bicycles.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But, hey, we bought a house. We made the mistake of buying a house a few years ago, and it only has an electric garage door opener, so.
Oh, really?
What can I do?
Yeah, that's just kind of funny.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, you've driven.
It's my panic button.
If you fall and you can't get up.
Yeah.
If you.
Red Cross.
If you've driven a lot, though, you were saying. And so
I worked at a farm in Purcellville, Virginia, and used to, like, drive one of their pickup trucks to growers-only vegetable markets every other day. You know, I've driven across country multiple times in driveway cars, and just for various reasons and jobs, I've actually driven an incredible amount.
What do you think you learned from not driving? Like, is there something that you kind of experiences or knowledge that you gain from that?
I think that, you know, when you're a pedestrian or a bicyclist, and I think you hit this, you wrote a recent column just this past week about bike counting, but where you were talking about sitting in an intersection, just your average American intersection, for 2 hours and looking at it. I think when you're a pedestrian or a bicyclist, you realize how insane, like, our intersections are, or how insane our land use is. You realize that, you know, as a pedestrian or bicyclist, the minute you step off that curb, you're worried about getting hit by motor vehicles. Motor vehicles are your biggest enemy. You're worried about, you know, there's all the tire dust and like smog and, you know, bad air quality. I mean, like cars,
noise too. Don't forget noise.
Noise is brutal. I mean, like walking down a boulevard and it's like you can't even have a conversation because you're like talking over the cars. I think, you know, not having a car makes you realize how dominant automobiles are in terms of urban design and the built human environment.
Yeah. The next part of this book is on page 92. And so you write, this is one of my favorite pictures of this era because it depicts politics as its sleaziest. And it's the famous picture of the last streetcar in Minneapolis being burned while these two guys are shaking hands and exchanging a check and grinning like, and so that's what those are, right? In front of them, standing on the streetcar tracks. So you're talking about the decline of the Twin Cities Rapid Transit Company and how that happened. Do you want to just talk about this picture and why you think it's so interesting? You put it on the cover of your book, right? So this is very important for you.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, the two guys who are on the cover of this are a guy named Fred Osana, who's on the right. And Fred Osana, I mean, the two guys, they've got, like, the two-tone shoes and the fedora hat and the jacket. I mean, they totally look like they're out of Mad Men or gangsters. And they were, in fact, gangsters. Fred Osana, who's on the right, was an attorney for Isidore Blumenfeld, whose sort of street gangsta name was Kid Can.
You know, Kid Can's been on our podcast before, too, because we interviewed this guy who wrote the book about Auggies. Neil Carlin.
Right on.
He wrote a book about Auggies, which is Kid Can used to hang out there all the time.
Oh, right on.
Auggie Ratner's nightclub in downtown Minneapolis, actually not too far from where we are right now.
Sure, sure. And, like, another book that Ken is very fond of is a book called Stopping the Presses, which is by the daughter of Walter Liggett, who was a journalist who, in part for his criticism of Floyd Olson, was murdered in front of his wife and child, in front of his daughter, in downtown Minneapolis by Kid Can, who gunned him down. And Isidore Blumenfeld, the St. Paul was kind of run in the 30s by the Jewish mob, by Isidore Blumenfeld and a guy who was known as Davy the Jew Berman, and
they don't call people that anymore.
Yeah, you know, but people don't think about it. But you know, there was the Italian mafia, but there was also the Jewish mafia, and like Blumenfeld basically escaped prosecution for multiple murders and retired in Florida and died of old age in the early 70s, I think.
So you've got on the right,
and so Osana on the right of this picture was his attorney, or was friends with him, and Osana had been an attorney for a company called National City Lines. And National City Lines was a front company that was started by a consortium of General Motors, Firestone, and Standard Oil of California, and a bunch of other companies. I think Mack Truck basically conspired together to create this front company called National City Lines and also Pacific City Lines out in the West Coast, whose job was to buy up and convert urban streetcar networks to buses, to GM buses. And the goal was to not only sell more GM buses, but to open up urban areas to automobile sales, because Alfred Sloan, who was the president of General Motors in the 1920s, realized that General Motors and other car companies had sort of glutted the market for cars in the 20s by selling them to rural and suburban folks, and that if they really wanted to keep selling cars, they needed to open up cities and get city dwellers into driving and owning automobiles. And so they created this front company called National City Lines, and they were aided by a piece of legislation that was called the Public Utilities Holding Company Act of 1936. And I don't know if anyone's done, or 1935, I don't know if anyone's done research on that act, but my guess is that GM or various companies lobbied for it. And the act forced, prior to World War II, a lot of streetcar companies, a lot of cities did not have electric lighting. Prior to World War II, a lot of cities were still using gas lighting, and electrification was just beginning to happen. And the biggest consumers of electricity were streetcar lines. And so a lot of public utilities owned streetcar lines. They were what's called vertically integrated as companies. And because the streetcar lines were the biggest consumer of electricity. So like the utility company in many cities and states would own the various streetcar lines in that state. And the Public Utilities Holding Company Act of 1935 or 1936 required that utility companies divest themselves of their streetcar lines. It was part of a lawsuit under the Sherman Antitrust Act. And suddenly you had all these streetcar companies, because of this law, dumped on the market at the same time in the middle of a depression. And GM had created this front company, National City Lines, that was right there to buy them up. And so they were able, over maybe a 20-year span, to buy up and dismantle electric streetcar lines in over 100 U.S. Cities. Or 100 streetcar lines in over 45 U.S. cities. And Fred O'Sana, who's pictured on the cover of the book, was a National City Lines attorney. He worked for National City Lines for a while. And National City Lines was convicted of conspiracy, a conviction that was upheld by, I think it was the Seventh Circuit or Chicago Federal Appeals Court in, I believe it was 1951 or 1952 that the conviction was upheld. So it's not like some myth that there was a conspiracy. There was a conspiracy. I mean, you can go and read the court case. And unfortunately, by like the early 50s, they'd already destroyed all these streetcar lines. And so the penalty for doing this was nominal damages. You know, each company got a $1,000 fine, and Roy Fitzgerald, who was the president of National City Lines at that point, got like a $1 fine, and nobody did any jail time. And you know, they basically got away with destroying transit systems in the United States, which at that time were privately owned.
Yeah, and one narrative that I hear, or I've heard a couple times in reaction to the story that you just told, is that, yeah, well, but streetcar companies at that period were losing money, and were these private companies that were just basically for real estate development. And once the real estate got developed, then they were kind of this loss on the books for someone like Thomas Lowry or whoever, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think...
And they were kind of doomed and fated to go into obsolescence anyway, so really there was this sort of shady business, but it was inevitable that this would happen this way. So what do you think of that story?
I think there's some merit to it. I think, however, that the thing that's missing is that the... Number one, the conspiracies did take place. I mean, what you were witnessing was a battle of a corporate battle. You know, you were witnessing the up-and-coming automotive industry in the 1930s and Standard Oil and the oil industry, which realized that if it wanted to keep doing business, it needed to hitch its cart to the auto industry, versus the streetcar industry, which had been like the dominant form of transportation in the United States, and the rail industry, which had been the dominant form of transportation in the United States. So it was kind of like the new up-and-coming corporate megalopolis versus the old. And I think that the other factor is that, you know, starting in the 1930s with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the U.S. government and public taxpayers were pouring money into a publicly subsidized highway system for motor vehicles that was directly competing with the private rail system. So, you know, yes, it's true that these companies were declining, but they were declining because they had to compete with a publicly subsidized highway system, which if it actually had to pay for itself, wouldn't be able to compete.
Yeah, so let's go to that's a good segue for the next section, because you kind of the end, the last parts of your book, you talk about the status quo, sort of what's happening in America and Minnesota today. You talk about MnDOT, right? So you got a picture on the left of a guy who's kind of being devoured by cars. It's kind of a disturbing cartoon, Andy, to be honest with you. But yeah, and you write
based
the following.
Based on the B horror movie, The Swarm.
Oh, The Swarm. Okay. Yeah. The Minnesota Department of Transportation spends over $1 billion a year much of which doesn't even pass through the legislature but comes directly to the agency from state and federal gas taxes. MnDOT's control over the money gives them incredible political power. The agency literally owns legislators, people like Mark Arata, a former Republican state senator, whose private road building employer received $74 million in MnDOT contracts. And then you said that the same sort of thing happens in other states, and there are many stories suggesting that other DOTs also use their political might to bully opponents into submission, either directly or through local metropolitan planning organizations. Many highway agencies, like the Pennsylvania Turnpike Authority, spend $1 million per year just lobbying state and federal lawmakers. Others are able to influence politicians by paying them legal retainer fees or via contracts to their employers. What I like about this book, Andy, you don't really pull any punches. You know, even though it's like, it seems to be a small volume, you're kind of talking about political connections that most people shy away from or don't want to discuss. So
yeah, and I feel like in the book, if you get the book, everything is heavily footnoted, and if you look at the bibliography, which is an annotated bibliography, you can read other books, and I think for anybody who's incredibly interested in highway politics and the history of highway agencies, one of the most important books to read is Robert Caro's book about Robert Moses called The Power Broker. And this was a book that came out in the early 70s, and it won a Pulitzer Prize, and it's often ranked as in the top 200 nonfiction books
in the history of
the U.S. and the books.
Yeah, and it's a really terrific book.
It's an incredible book. And if you've lived in New York City in particular, you know a lot of the spots that are being discussed in the book. But Robert Moses was, he invented the modern highway agency on some level. And the book sort of talks about how the rise of agency politics and state agencies, whether they be highway agencies or military industrial complex or various other forms of, basically government-sanctioned corporations that are created for the construction or accomplishment of a particular project. And in the case of highway departments and in the case of a few other things, if they have dedicated funding sources, and in the case of MnDOT and most state DOTs or state departments of transportation, the state DOTs have dedicated fuel taxes. So in Minnesota and most other states, literally 90% of other U.S. states, all of the fuel taxes at the state level that are collected go directly to the State Department of Transportation and are dedicated for being spent on highways.
Yeah, they're constitutionally in there. We had on the podcast earlier Chris Wells, who's a McAllister professor of history, and he wrote a book that came out, I think, earlier this year called Car Country. I should give you my copy, Andy. You can read it. He was basically talking about what you're exactly talking about this dedicated source of income that creates the freeway industrial complex, right?
Yeah, and you know, even when these agencies have long outlived their usefulness, they still keep building roads. And in the transportation politics in Minnesota and a lot of other states, you can be assured, because you have this dedicated source of revenue at the state level, that if there's a transportation problem, generally speaking, the DOT is going to come up with a highway solution to that problem, because they know that it can get funded. To get transit funded is much more difficult, because you either have to pass a half-cent sales tax or something to fund transit, and then you're competing with other state needs. Or you have to come up with some other funding mechanism for transit, whereas highways have this dedicated funding source, and there are tons of jobs and union jobs and contracting firms and what have you that can be counted on to support a given highway project. And it's the reason that Minnesota and tons of other states keep building new highways and keep adding new highway lanes, even when, because of global climate change. And actually, since 2008, vehicle miles traveled per driver have actually declined. So there are fewer people driving now than there were in 2008, yet we're still building more highway lanes. That has a lot to do with these funding mechanisms.
Yeah, the engineers that I talk to sometimes think that's a momentary blip in because of the economy. But you wouldn't agree with that?
No, I think that the reason the blip, so-called blip, happened is because in 2008, gas prices reached $4 a gallon. And I think $4 a gallon or thereabouts is here to stay. And I think that if, for example, we had some conflict with Syria or just
that
because...
That never happened. I don't see that happening anymore.
Or just because of what's called peak oil, the fact that at some point the amount of petroleum in the world is less than the demand for petroleum, you're going to see the price spike incredibly. And I think that when gas gets to $5, $6, $7 a gallon, people just plain old aren't going to be able to afford to drive. And we ought to be preparing for that day by, like, building alternatives for people instead of spending money on a system of highways that no one's going to be able to afford to use.
So that's a good segue to this next page that I picked out, which is page 112 of your book, Andy. Down the left, you have retro transportation, and it's just a guy walking down the street. I like that. It's and that's the cartoon side. On the right side, you talk about sort of some of the attempts in the federal transportation funding program to change the to change things or change car culture or whatever.
Sure.
And so take us through the history of this. So you talk about Ice-T, the first incarnation of Ice-T.
Well, like going back to your thing of. You know, streetcar or transit systems being on a decline that was inevitable. Well, like all of these streetcar systems and interurban systems and commuter rail systems were having to compete with private with publicly subsidized highways, and you know it was hard to do that. If you have some like system where people just have to pay for the price of the car and don't necessarily have to pay for the highways or the whole infrastructure, it's not a very level playing field. And as a result, by the late 60s, all these streetcar and commuter rail systems started to go bankrupt. And especially in very big urban areas like New York City or San Francisco or Chicago, urban rail networks are much more efficient mover of people than highways. And I should go back to this idea. Like, if you ever took a driver's education course, you're taught to keep a 2-second following distance between you and the vehicle in front of you. And that turns out to be about what people maintain. Regardless of the speed that they're traveling, there's about 2 seconds between vehicles. And so if you do the math, times 60 seconds times 60 minutes, that means that on a given highway lane in an hour, you can move about 1,800 cars per hour. But because people change lanes and are not perfectly efficient, the accepted highway industry standard is 1,500 cars per hour per lane. So, like, even if everybody traveled in 3-person carpools, the maximum that you could move on a given highway lane is 4,500 people per hour. And if you contrast that, a single track of transit takes up about the same amount of space as a highway lane. And if you imagine a typical subway train in New York or somewhere else, you can carry up to 2,000 people on a 10-car subway train in rush hour. And so if you ran trains, that's 2,000 people per train, at 5-minute headways, what is that? That's like, my math is terrible, but
60 divided by 5.
Yeah, it's
60,000 people.
In any case, like whatever, my from being at a baseball game all day, and, like
the engineers listening to this are gonna just get
wetting in their
idiots.
Pants. Yeah, but the engineers listening to this didn't listen to a Twins A's game today and consume huge amounts of beer. But in any case, like you can move 20,000 people per hour per lane on a single track of transit. So, like, transit's big advantage over automobiles is the ability to move large amounts of people in a small space. And if you use split-level transit, split-level commuter rail cars, similar to what they're using, I think on Northwest
the North Star Rail.
North Star Rail, but they definitely use them in Chicago. Can up that as high as 40,000 people per hour. So transit's biggest advantage over cars is its people moving ability, and the fact that it more efficiently uses space. And when commuter railroads started to go bankrupt in the late 60s, cities like New York, where 50% of the people who get into downtown are arriving on commuter rail or subway trains, were suddenly faced with the situation where, all of our subways and commuter railroads are going bankrupt. We are not going to be able to move these people into our downtown by any other means. And they had to, the cities had to take over these transit systems. This happened in the Twin Cities when
sure.
Carl Pohlad, decided that he was, either going to close down or sell off, Twin Cities Rapid Transit, which at that point had just been reduced to buses. The city of Minneapolis and the city of St. Paul were like, oh, crap, we were reliant on these transit systems to move people, and they had to take them over. And so they, in the late 60s, the economy overall was in the doldrums, and so they were reliant on federal transportation dollars, and the federal government started setting aside some money in the late 60s and early 70s in particular, to help states with the fact that they were having to take over these bankrupt railroads and bankrupt transit systems. And if a state DOT wanted to get this money, it had to come up with a transit project or a transit spending thing to spend it on. And this sort of schism within federal transportation funding went on throughout the 70s, where they would have a budget separate for transit and a separate budget for automobiles. And in the late 80s, they devised this idea called iced tea, which was the inner...
Can I mention that I'm drinking an iced tea right now?
All right. The Intermodal Surface Transportation Efficiency Act. And it was negotiated, I believe, and signed in 1989, or maybe it was 1991. It was under the first Bush administration. And for the first time, it said, okay, we're going to create a pot of federal transportation dollars gleaned from the federal gas tax, and we're going to make it flexible. You can spend a large chunk of it either on transit or on automotive. And the idea was to try to level the playing field and encourage states to make investments in public transit. And to some degree, it had a positive impact. I think that in states like New Jersey or New York or even in the San Francisco Bay Area, where you already had established transit agencies and established rail transit.
And the political sort of network that allows
it. Yeah, and the political
and the constituency
network
to call
constituency
for it.
That supported that. They flexed a lot of those federal dollars towards transit and improved their transit systems. And that's why, like, the East Coast to this day has, like, much better transit than the Midwest or the San Francisco Bay Area or even the Los Angeles metro area. The problem with this was that at the state level, state gas taxes were still dedicated to highways. So when a state applies for federal money for a transit project, this is kind of complicated, but when the state applies for money and says, hey, we want to build the Hiawatha Light Rail Line out to the Twin Cities Airport, and we want federal assistance building this, well, the federal government will pay anywhere from 50 to 80% of that project, but you have to come up with, as a state, with the other 50 to 80% of the money.
50 to 20%.
That's right. 50 to 20% of the money. And so for states, especially states that don't have dedicated transit funding sources, that's much more difficult. And especially for states where your fuel tax is dedicated to highway spending. And as a result, it's been very difficult for Minnesota or certain other Midwest states to raise the money to meet the federal match to build out transit systems. And that's a problem still to this day. And that's sort of what I talk about.
What do you think of the current... I just read an article today about... where was it? It was in either MinnPost. It might have been in MinnPost. About the Mark Dayton... Because apparently Charlie Zelli, the MnDOT head right now, who's Mark Dayton's appointment...
former head of Jefferson Bus Lines.
Yeah, so he has a little bit of experience with transit, with privately run intercity transit.
He runs a bus line, yeah, sure.
Anyway, but he's going around trying to convince state legislators to support gas tax, and then this, as part of this package, they would also pass a sales tax dedicated to transit in the metro area. So that was the original Dayton plan that didn't happen this last legislative
session.
Yeah,
I mean,
what do you think about that
plan? Yeah, I mean, what you're witnessing is, like, and I talk about this in the book a little bit, is that we have nationally transportation politics. And if you look at an election map of any presidential election in the last, like, almost 20 years, you will see that cities and sort of dense suburban areas tend to vote Democrat, and less dense suburban areas and rural areas tend to vote Republican. And I would call this the politics of place. Where you are and how you live kind of influences how you vote for a variety of reasons. I won't get into that, but the book gets into that. There have been a lot of studies about this by various people. Each state is a microcosm of that. So that at the state level in Minnesota, you have outstate legislators, whether they're for the DFL or the Republican Party. And in the outstate areas, because those areas are low density, their main mode of transportation is roads and highways. And they are only going to allow the metro area to raise a sales tax to pay for transit if they get something out of it. You know, every legislator's attitude, unfortunately, both in state legislatures and in the federal government and Congress, is what's in it for me and what's in it for my district. And so you have all these outstate Republicans and DFL legislators who are like, if you want to raise a metro sales tax, I got to get some gas tax for me so I can spend it in my district. And that was sort of the Faustian bargain that Dayton and various DFL legislators make, which is that if they want to get money for transit, they have to give more money for highway building.
Yeah, that's kind of my understanding of the landscape of the legislature, too. So, I mean, is your sense that that's better than nothing?
Yeah, on some level. I mean, I thought actually the sort of final bargain at the end of the legislative session was that they would give one-time bonding money for highways in exchange for being able to get money for transit or being able to... What I find, like, absolutely outrageous is the metro area, if you were to put it up to a public referendum, the metro area is willing to raise taxes on itself, right, because it's a metro sales tax to pay for transit. Yet, in order to do that, it has to get approval of legislators who are not from the metro area. You know, these because of our taxation laws, these people have, like, approval power over what we want to decide for ourselves. And they want something in it for them. So they're not even going to allow us to raise taxes on ourselves. It's not even like it impacts them to pay for transit.
This kind of reminds me of New York State politics. And maybe, in fact, cities and states everywhere in the country have the same problem.
It's repeated in every state. In New York City, Mayor Bloomberg wants to institute congestion pricing, which is this idea of charging people a tax or toll for driving in the New York metro area during peak hours. And that tax or toll would go to subsidizing non-automobile alternative transportation. And he can't get that passed because the legislature in New York State, just like in Minnesota, has final say on it. And there are a few legislators, often Democrats, like Silver, who's from Staten Island, who have final say or approval over what happens, who are blocking it at the state legislature.
Yeah. Yeah, that's New York we're talking, the New York,
yeah,
New
but
York State.
Yeah, but the same kind of thing happens in Minnesota, where you have people who, from the DFL who should know better, but they're blocking the metro area from, like, raising a sales tax on itself for transit because, you know, we're not, like, when, I can't think of his first name, but Murphy was head of the...
Steve Murphy,
yeah, was head of the, he was the head of the Transportation Committee
in the
Senate.
Yeah.
And he was from, like, Red Wing or something, and, like, he was a Boilermaker, a total union guy who, you know, was like, what's in it for Red Wing? You know, and he would not allow... the metro area to raise money for transit unless he got some sales for some gas taxes for highways for Red Wing. And, like, unfortunately, that's the kind of politics that goes on. And in sort of the book, I make a case for creating a state version of iced tea, a state version of the federal legislation where we just flex. Let's just flex state gas tax dollars and say that and come up with some formula by which different counties or different regions get a share equal to what they pay into it. And we say that each county or each region can spend that money however they want. If they want to spend it on transit, if an urban area wants to spend it on a light rail system or commuter rail system, they can.
You'd think libertarians would be into that idea too, you know, because it makes
sense.
Totally. It's like, hey, here's some freedom to make decisions at a local level instead of having everything have to run through this formula.
Yeah, I ask myself, where is the Minnesota Taxpayers League on this idea? You know, I mean, it's amazing to me that they're not going to support something like that because it is totally libertarian. It's just saying, hey, you know, Murphy or, you know, you people in Red Wing, you want to spend your money on highways, fine, but we want to spend it on transit.
Yeah. Your book is, you know, a little bit of a downer just because it's about the ubiquity and tenacity of car culture. But it does have some moments of optimism, and this is one of them on page 116. So you write, working in our favor, and this is talking about transit and kind of non-motorized transportation advocacy, working in our favor is the fact that building and maintaining fixed rail transit provides even more jobs than building highways. With skillful political leadership, a broad array of groups can be led to support transit projects. These include many of the same groups that currently support highways, like unions, construction contractors, heavy industry firms, architecture firms, and groups representing the disabled, the elderly, and voters who are unable to drive. So you're basically calling for a transit industrial complex to be formed or something.
Hell yeah, baby, bring it on.
Yeah.
And actually, you see sometimes when there was lobbying for Central Corridor Light Rail, you see a lot of unions and various other people at the state capitol lobbying for it. And the reality is that it creates more jobs than highways because, like, creating fixed rail transit in particular creates more jobs than building a highway. And then you create more jobs because you've got people who have to operate the system on a more intensive level than just bus drivers. You know, because you're committing infrastructure in the form of overhead wires and tracks and what have you.
Why isn't it happening today?
I think it's not happening because there's a lack of startup capital, and I think that the federal government at this point is the one source of startup capital. And like I say, in order to get those federal grants for Southwest Corridor or for various other things, you need to be able to raise matching funds. And Mark Dayton and the DFL can't seem to get it done at the state level to allow the Metro to raise a quarter or a half cent sales tax to get funding for transit. Or, like I say, creating a sort of flexible funding system where we amend the state constitution and allow state gas tax dollars to be spent on transit or however a particular county wants to spend it.
Andy, we got through the book. What's the lesson of this book?
I'm not sure. The main takeaway I want people to when they read the book is that, number one, to realize that, in my opinion, as they're currently arrayed, state DOTs are environmental public enemy number one. And we need to reform the way that we fund transportation. And the way we fund transportation, the funding mechanisms that you set up will dictate the transportation system that you get.
Yeah. And there's hope for change?
Yeah, I think there's hope for change. I mean, it's definitely happening in other states. I think that regardless of activism that you or I or other people do in terms of publishing or this, that, or the other thing, or at lobbying at the state legislature, I think the thing that will change it is gas prices. I mean, yeah. I think that when gas gets to $6, $7 a gallon, which I think is an inevitable thing, possibly in the next 10 years, you're going to see change because it's suburbia and certain modes of land use are absolutely unsustainable.
Yeah. Well, they're doing that in Massachusetts. I know the governor there said he made a no new roads pledge, which I'd like to see more states do that.
Yeah, it's called like a paving moratorium. You say like, hey, we've got enough highways and enough pavement and enough streets and enough parking. We're going to say no more new roads.
You know, like, Andy, we went through this whole book without talking about bikes at all, which is amazing considering it's you and me having a conversation for an hour. Where can people even buy this book?
Can buy it from Amazon, Why We Drive, Andy Singer, if you type it into Google or into Amazon. Or you can get it from the publisher, Microcosm Publishing. And hopefully at some point I'll have it on my website.
Yeah, yeah. Why don't you get in bookstores, or anymore?
They have a distributor. I don't even know what their distributor is. Something called Independent Publishing Group, IPG.
Yeah.
And that puts it in. I mean, you can get it through your bookstore.
What's your next project, Andy?
Just regular cartoons. I'm just a regular cartoonist. Actually, cartoons about transportation are like actually a small fraction of what I.
Well, yeah, you have a lot of stuff, and
yeah,
yeah, it's funny.
But this is my hobby. It's this or bass fishing, or baseball watching.
Yeah, well, we can do both at the same time as we proved today.
It's interesting. I mean, what can I say? You know.
Yeah. Okay. On that note, thanks for talking to me. It's been great. Your book's awesome. People should all buy this book.
And, thanks for interviewing me.
Yeah, you bet.
Thanks for all your awesome comments.
Thanks for listening to the Streets.mn podcast. If you have any feedback or ideas, you can comment on Streets.mn, on Twitter at StreetsMN, or you can email me at blindeke@gmail.com. So long from Nicollet Avenue.